The rule book and calendar of Kittery Embers, Book 1, is now available as an e-book for Kindle and other e-book reading devices for 99 cents. Search for Kittery Embers on Amazon.com or visit sherwinsleeves.com or radioghost.com for more information. The audio chapters will continue to be available for free, but if you like the story, please consider showing your support by purchasing and downloading the three books as they are made available. Thank you, my friends.
Well, I rode on the carousel until my horse tired. I threw darts at balloons till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland.
The rule book and calendar of Kittery Embers. Chapter 8, The Black Fire. A mad and motley dash proceeded from the wharf to the distant spot in the sea where Kittery Embers stood. The villagers ran, swam, hobbled, rowed, as though given all different instructions on the best way to make it to the shoals. Mrs. Gramshaw skimmed fast over the very ribbon of the waves, and with her long legs and homemade Gram shoes, she was the first to arrive in the tugging, warm-watered shoals. The clangorous grey rowboat struggled in soon after, knocking back and forth in the fray, and then Mrs. Brushes, Mr. Raggard, Mr. Thief, and the rest splashed along. Mrs. Gramshaw gripped Kittery's marble cheeks, kissed her cold forehead, and then stared into the stony, open eyes.
"Mustn't touch her, Keepsie,"
Mrs. Brushes cried out. Mrs. Gramshaw removed her hands, but only after she'd seen it. The merest flicker of spirit at the very limit of light.
"Oh, my letters,"
she gasped inwardly. She closed her eyes and for a moment wept before turning to meet the arriving villagers, soaked and knotted with concern, their hands hanging like fish just below the level of the waves.
"She is alive," Mrs. Gramshaw announced, "but deeply in the glimmers and hardly there. I said before that we must not move her in order to give Archie a chance to realize the Sea Minister's true message. But we cannot wait now. Another turn of the tide, and she will be lost."
The villagers stood, wet to the waists, and stared at the small face of the girl. Mrs. Brushes pushed forward and held her hands near Kittery, but not touching, as to demonstrate the proper distance.
"We cannot touch her, Keepsie. We cannot move her. We have to wait for Archie. Only he can bring her back,"
Mrs. Brushes said. Mrs. Gramshaw set her dripping hand on Mrs. Brushes' shoulder in a kindly, quieting way. "Mr. Aggard," she said, "your winch will be required. Mr. Thief, your men and shunt boat here within the hour, with Mr. Aggard's winch aboard. Mrs. Darra will need a wooden box, large enough to hold her, but one that won't topple, with props or sticks. She cannot fall. And Mrs. Winnick, when Muck comes to shore, have him assemble a party to search for Archie. I know he will anyway, but he'll go off himself without a thought. Fetch up a group yourself if he resists, and kindly inform Mr. Nundeen that he should remain on Second Hill to call out whatever news is to be had. Mr. Aggard and Thief and Mrs. Darra and Winnick struck off through the waves, arms raised, hastening like spoons and heavy batter toward the shore.
"Mrs. Brushes,"
Mrs. Gramshaw said discreetly, and held the wet-chinned woman back. "If we might have a word."
she said it in a way that served to dismiss the rest of the villagers. "We cannot move her," Mrs. Brush has said again, more severely now that they were alone. "She's in Glimmers, Zinley," Mrs. Gramshaw said seriously. "I don't need to tell you, of all people, what that means." "You always think I'm partial, but that's not it. The history warns us, Keepsie, against just this very thing," Mrs. Brush has said. "It does indeed. And it also speaks of a second way in the event of Glimmers." The tall housekeeper whispered this on a downward slant to convey the deeper import. After a moment, and with reluctance, Mrs. Brush has spoke. "You cannot be talking about the stone addendum." "Don't plead ignorance, Mrs. Brush, as we haven't time. But it is because of that familiarity, that partialness, yes, to that far side of things, that I must beg you to start a black fire." Mrs. Gramshaw said this, and held Mrs. Brush as tighter still. Mrs. Brush has caught hold of her indignation, and then her mouth closed slowly. Mrs. Gramshaw came around her, so she could not turn away. "Do not tell me it is beyond your memory, your reach, your power." "I have never set a black fire," Mrs. Brush has cried out. "But you can, Zinley, I know that much, and you must now. I tell you solemnly and swear to it that the very fewest of us will know what you have done." "How will you explain it? They will see the smoke and my absence. Everyone will know it was I," Mrs. Brush has hissed. "When all is said and done, Zinley, you will be remembered in the kindest way. But for some time, it is true, that will not be the case. With the book burned and Archie missing, with the cloven hire mounting in Kittery, in Glimmers, we will have to do what we can, not what we like or prefer. And let us not be colourful nor ashamed of who we are and what we may be or become. Of us all, you are the least distant from the spirit of the monarch. I have no judgment of that. Good is not always good, and bad not always bad. In fact, both are required in the service of our procession. You will start the black fire for us, and that will keep Kittery alive until we find Archie. And after you have done this thing, you will be free to go, without resistance, I promise, to the White Palace, to serve her, as perhaps has always been your destiny." Partial Minister Battlegrass sat in a cavernous chamber in the White Palace on something that may or may not have been a chair. It wasn't hot and spitting bright flames was all that recommended it. Rosy fires burned here and there on the wall, floor and ceiling, all of which pulsed and sighs and moved in the bleary treatment of nightmare. He shuddered in the loamy heat and pushed roughly at the long boughs of smoke that fell across him like the ghosts of trees. In the high middle air, a silver jet stream turned endlessly. It was all too much for his eyes, a dizzying effect of contracting cinder walls, scattered flames, and the various smokes, black and grey. Not only did he lose his sense of place within the room, feeling at times seated on the ceiling or wall, but there was a suffocating quality of being covered, as though he'd been buried in the earth. The White Palace, indeed. Certainly, it was crystalline and immaculate on the outside, and gave every impression of being the fair home of a good-hearted ruler. But inside, it was a smouldering cinder works. When he'd first arrived, the PM had wandered slowly down the lifeless halls, calling out softly for the monarch, trying not to be too sing-songy as he announced, "I have the rule-book, Majesty." But when frightened to the marrow, his awful habit was to speak in a kind of mincing lullaby. He saw it as a removal first, a negative awareness of shadow beneath shadow, and he turned sharply right. "I have the rule-book, Majesty," he said, infecting the word rule with unfortunate melody. The shape in the smoke stepped closer until he saw the soot-run silver hair, the ruined skirt-rag hanging from the stick-like body. The book was suddenly no longer in his hands. The monarch's face pressed instantly, massively, dreamlike into his, her two red-smeared eyes nearly touching his own. "All," she rasped, "for a funny little rainbow hat with bells and bits of bird glass." Just as suddenly as the book was gone from his hand, it was there, the heavy, crumpled hat of the full minister. "Well, put it on," the monarch said, smiling with a dislocating sag of her jaw. The minister set the potent hat, festooned with trinkets, on his head. "Well, if it isn't full Minister Battlegrass," the old woman said, with a forgery of startled kindness. Against himself, and despite his fear, a childlike bubble of happiness shot through him. His full ministerial powers coursed through his veins, a tingling electrical current at his fingertips. "Thank you, monarch," he said, bowing only slightly to prevent the cumbersome hat from tumbling off. "And now, perhaps, an errand, perhaps the last," she said. "An errand, Majesty. Perhaps we shall see. Come along," the monarch said, waving the rule-book through a ledge of smoke and clearing the way. "I have the Triumvirus Vermis, Picus. I have the book, and we shall see what my own rule-book requires now." They entered a torch-lit stone hall. The floor dipped sharply, and the minister noticed a peculiar ruddy ointment dribbling from the ceiling and falling in large splattering drops onto the very wet floor like a kind of muddy rain. The hole narrowed into a fissure and dropped sharply, and the minister had to place his feet against the stone stubble to prevent a fall. There was a thin river beneath them now, an awful cemetery murk lapping below their feet. The hole turned and suddenly dilated into a small cupped room. The thick river pooled around the legs of a low wooden table. Jabbing from the wall above it was a saucer with a muddy cake of candle wax. The monarch pinched the candle wick with her fingers, and a green flame guttered. There was an old leather volume set on the table below. The monarch's own rule book, it must be, the minister thought. He tried not to look at it. The old woman leaned over the table, flipping through the pages of her own rule-book, and then paused, reading.
Of course, she said at last. Rule number 701. With book and bird and all in hand, now wear the girl and walk the land. The minister stared at the green flame of the candle as the monarch faced him. The girl, minister, the girl, she said. Battlegrass swallowed roughly. There is some talk that she has been engloomed. I myself believe that she is lodged in the littoral between the lodestones. My rule book says otherwise, the monarch said. Do you doubt it? Of course not, the minister said, as soberly as he could. Then we have only to look. A simple operation to locate her. She swept Kittery's rule book in the air. With the chimers, the monarch explained reluctantly, I will be able to read her book as easily as I read my own. Has that silly hat replaced the thing it sits upon? Upon its mention, the minister tilted the hat to a more thoughtful angle. Just as my rule-book tells us she is here in Olive, her rule-book will tell us where, by the feature of its most current rule. The monarch set Kittery's rule-book down atop her own and lifted a tattered shawl from an umbrella-like object beside the table. Beneath the rag, perhaps engloomed as well, stood a woodpecker. Gripped in the bird's frozen right claw was a small black mouse. Around the mouse's neck, the pale scarf of a worm, the scepter of flesh, as it was sometimes called, the trimus picus vermis. If you will be so awfully kind, the monarch said. She tugged her dress to better expose the sour flesh of her shoulder. The minister took the bird by the neck, spun it slowly in the air as though a delicate project of sticks and glue. He brought it slowly toward the monarch so that she might complain if he was doing it wrong. The instant the bird's claws touched her skin, they sprang like a trap, biting deeply for the bone. The minister stepped back as the monarch screamed. Thick brown blood shot from her shoulder and dropped softly into the exactly similar liquid at their feet. It is her blood, the minister thought. The river is her blood. And everywhere he looked, he could see it now. The monarch continued shrieking in a miserable marriage of laughter and tears. Still whining, she pounced upon Kittery's book, flapping through its pages as though knowing exactly where to stop. The trimus stood firmly, regally, on her shoulder. She stilled and huddled over a page. Rule 97, Roderick, she said weakly. She staggered to a side and the minister moved in quickly. She read Kittery's newest rule, and she was not reading it so that the minister might simply hear it. She was reading it so that he could solve it. She read it twice, crumpling downward as she did. For every hill, there is a hole. For every stone, a fire. What's inside out comes outside in to make the girl a liar. The monarch splashed down into the river of blood. The brown liquid streamed across her submerged face, covering her open eyes, spilling into her mouth. She was trying to say something the minister could see, and he broke down on his knees and lifted her head from the river. Bring her to me, she shrieked into his face. The minister slipped his hand beneath her back to help her up, but she tore free and stabbed his cheek with a long finger and twisted. She held him like this with the penetrating finger and then breathed hot over his face, each word like a boiled stone rubbed upon his eyes. Before they start the black fire, bring her to me. The full minister pulled her hand from his cheek and let her drop back down into the brown liquid. Then he stood and began to run up the awful river of the monarch's blood. He would find her, that much was certain. But he didn't think he could do it alone. He needed help. He needed very special help.
I walked through the river in kind of dream. hand in hand, the all-knowing river and me. To the clamour of rushes and deeply bowing trees, and drunk making blossom the blush to be seen.
There was wind on his face, hung with wet lures of grey and white, as though full of rain. Perhaps, Archie thought, I am in a storm. His fists balled beneath him, frosted with the cold of the sky. But it was not rain that blotted the air. Bits of fog and misty scrims made letters in the wind and self-erased. Olive lay far below, a lash of yellow beach, the leaden sea, unmoving to his eye at this height. Even the snowy waves were caught in their roll, locked in place. The wings held firm above him, neither steering nor beating. He asked them to lift, to turn, but they did not respond. He stared down at his hands and begged them to unclench, but they remained as rocky and motionless as the waves below. Nor could he shift his gaze or twist his head. What was wrong? The sun tumbled in yellows behind him. And then he remembered. The sea minister. How could he have forgotten? But what exactly could he remember? His mind moved arduously over faint images of tentacles and watercolor depths. Archie and the wings rose in the sprawling wind. These higher clouds were deadly, thin and sleety. Long grey knives that flicked and cut with ice as he shot through the air. He soared above the highest dagger cloud. The dreamy bowl of space was now visible. A handful of grey stars twinkled anciently. It was the stars that did it, that reminded him. Whether the sea minister had told him or not, the message stood out from his blood. He closed his eyes and opened them. It was why he was all locked up, and he could do something about that. He could do something right now. He knew how. He had been taught. He felt through his body going deeper and deeper with some invisible hand, searching for an inside knob that had always been there, but never turned, never touched. And as this interior arm spun like a key in the distant lock of himself, his legs moved outward and then through him, articulating silently and above him their new freedom. Through the frosted smear of vision, he saw his hands, clamped and ice-like, turn now darker and smaller, and then quickly rough with feathers. His fingers thinned into talons, and his wrists trembled in fluffy down. And when he next looked, the massive wings were gone, replaced by a newer, sleeker set.
no longer a contraption of boy and borrowed feathers. He was now a bird himself. He traced out in a full, sleek arc, and then flew for the black sky. There were full stars around him now, blindly old and raging. Black and white feathers trembled about him, and the ice of the wind that hit his face now was like an invitation to speed, faster, colder, higher. For a while he spun out in the hypnotic shift, but then he bared out flat and cooled himself down. It was a summoning charge from within. Go down, he told himself, fast and now. He trimmed his feathers and barreled into a dive. He smelled the sulphurous iron burning and banked toward it. The black smoke stood through the sky like a burnt needle. He laid himself alongside this needling and shot down its length like starlight in the finest silver of his speed. Feathers to the smoke, smoke to the ground, Archie to the girl, to Kittery.
Cold is the water, it freezes your already cold mind, already cold, cold mind. And death is at your doorstep, and it will steal your innocence, but it will not steal your substance. But you are not alone in this, and you are not alone in this. As brothers we will stand and we'll hold your hand, hold your hand. To whom you gave life. And you have your choices, and these are what make man great, his ladder to the stars. But you are not alone in, you are not alone in this. As brothers we will stand and we'll hold your hand, hold your hand. But I will tell the night, and where your sight, but I can't move the mountains for you.
The shunt boat brought her ashore. The winch grappled the box, and the box held her still. The villagers rushed in confused urges as the box was lowered from the boat onto the big wheeled cart on the beach. But once it was tied down, they found their unison and began pushing it up over the sand as though this was their daily work. Several of the villagers walked ahead and stomped the soft sand so the cartwheels did not sink too deeply. Mrs. Gramshaw halted the procession at the square. With her excellent eyes, she could see the fine line of smoke rising from Second Hill. "Thank you, all," Mrs. Gramshaw said. "Mr. Agard, Mr. Wellfleet, Mr. Dodge and I will convey her to the meeting spot. There we hope to bring Archie as soon as we can. But to prevent the monarch from discovering our end, I would ask that everyone return home now. Close your curtains. Sit and wait until Mr. Nundine has made his calling, keeping Kittery safe. keeps us all safe. Mrs. Gramshaw and the three men waited beside the cart as the villagers reluctantly departed, and when the wooden doors of the small stone homes had closed and the tiny square windows were pent with curtains, they began to push the straining cart once more. Mrs. Gramshaw directed them now through the square, up the leaving road, and called for a second halt when they arrived at the Canlily Fields. She would go on alone from here. They were to return home, shut their doors and curtains, await Mr. Nundine's all clear. When they were gone from sight, she broke open the wooden crate and lifted the girl, stiff as iron and heavy as a boulder, into her arms and struggled into the white tree maze of the salt forest. Mr. Nundine rushed down from the top of Second Hill when he saw her. "Quietly, Mr. Nundine," Mrs. Gramshaw hissed from the strain of her burden. Mr. Nundine put a hand to his bearded mouth that he not bellow out his conversation. "I tried to stop her," he half shouted. "It's all right," Mrs. Gramshaw said. She had no energy for other words. "Is it?" Mr. Nundine began. "Because though I did try, I could not get close. I was unable." "We have made our choice, Kieran," Mrs. Gramshaw said. "Either Kittery will sleep forever, or it is this. It is a black fire that I requested Mrs. Brush's set, and we will tell no one." Mr. Nundine further gripped his bearded mouth, sensing himself unable to control the volume of his protest. Mrs. Brush has sat in a tired-out daze on the far side of the glossy lodestone. She was folded low over herself, almost sleeping, but here and there moaned and shook her head in repentance, in reluctance and shame for what she had done and what she was about to do. The black fire burned in the middle air, several feet above the stone itself. The flames clashed in a silent battle of black blades and silken shadows. Rising up from the shared point of its cold heat was a single line of ebony smoke. Mrs. Gramshaw heaved Kittery upon the stone and then climbed up herself. She wiped the sweat from her forehead with a cloth from her dresses. Mrs. Brusher stood with a wobble, but yet there was a clarity to her movement, clearness in her eyes. "You know what I must do," Mrs. Brusher said. "Go," Mrs. Gramshaw said, "and thank you." And Mrs. Brusher's, only a moment ago hung with exhaustion and shame, now fleetly spun off down the hill, heading for the White Palace. "Mr. Nundine, you will go to the square now," Mrs. Gramshaw said, now feeling the need to collapse herself. "When you arrive, call out the all clear. None of this may be given voice, and I am sorry to do it." Even as she apologized, the tall housekeeper had begun to pass her fingers through the air to issue the small injunctive hex. Mr. Nundine accepted it genially. He felt cool silk wrapping around his heart. He could never speak of the black fire now, not even if he needed to. When he'd finally lumbered off down the hill, Mrs. Gramshaw once again edged Kittery toward the floating fire. There was a thunder roll from the earth and a terrible scent of ruined salt, of dregs. She paused only a moment to look, as just over the edge of the hill, like a strangely square bird, she saw it. The whimsical trinkets and box of rainbows that was the full minister's hat. Kittery was only inches from the fire, and Mrs. Gramshaw lunged to push her into the black flames. "I don't think so, Keepsy," the minister said. He passed his hand once through the air and touched his forehead, and Mrs. Gramshaw was instantly arrested, mid-push, arms flung out, fingers pressing at Kittery's backside. Behind him, a dozen shapeless cinders dripped like heaving mounds of dirt come to life, in gasps of fire, oil shedding from their soft bleeding sides into the ground, the cloven higher, like headless horses risen half dead from the earth. Her lips nearly trembled with the effort to speak, but she could do nothing but watch as the minister approached the stone with the slouching horses. He dragged Kittery to the edge of the stone and hoisted her across the leaky black carcass of the nearest horse. And then he returned. "Sorry, my dear," he said. "You were right and I was wrong. She was engloomed after all. Of course it can pay to be wrong, and one can be punished for being right." The minister turned and pointed to Kittery. But Mrs. Gramshaw couldn't follow this. She was frozen in her pushing pose, face struck skyward, where her excellent eyes could see the bird falling like a feathered star directly down the needle of the Blackfriars smoke. "You have what you want, but can't seem to get it," the minister said jovially, and pushed her into the fire. "A walk down the path, through the woods, the falling snow, my neighbor, black as ice, a silver dream, as we go skating down the stream." As an e-book for Kindle and other e-book reading devices for 99 cents. Search for Kittery Embers on Amazon.com or visit sherwinsleeves.com or radioghost.com for more information. The audio chapters will continue to be available for free, but if you like the story, please consider showing your support by purchasing and downloading the three books as they are made available. Thank you, my friends.